email ray@rte.ie. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, we will come back to memories of Sinead O'Connor, and we have a musical tribute before the end of the programme as well from Shobzy. And we have to do the quiz as well, so we're looking for two of you to come on after 4 o'clock and take part in our daily quiz. And the prize this week is a two-night stay in the Hendrick in Smithfield, which is there in Dublin 7, just off Smithfield Square. A great location to go and explore everything that Dublin City has to offer. HendrickDublin.ie, HendrickDublin.ie. It's a good prize. Here's your qualifying question today. Who scored Ireland's only goal in yesterday's World Cup game against Canada? Was it Katie McCabe or Katie Taylor? Who scored Ireland's only goal in yesterday's World Cup game against Canada? Was it Katie McCabe or Katie Taylor? 0818715925. 0818715925. Now, I've been reading this book over the last few days, Cracking the Case, Inside the Mind of a Top Garda. It's the new book by retired Chief Superintendent Christy Mangan. It's a biography of Christy's career, which spanned 40 years and saw him deal with the toughest of crimes, including some of the biggest murder cases Ireland has had. He's the most senior Garda to ever write about his career, and it truly is a thrilling, insightful, harrowing. And it sort of just gives us a window into a world that very few of us would have a window into. Yesterday, 26th of July, marked 41 years to the day that he first stepped foot into Templemore Garda College, and he joins me now in Studio 7. How are you doing, Christy?
Good, Ray, thank you.
Did you realise yesterday was your 26th anniversary?
I did realise. I still remember it when you walk through the gates. It certainly leaves an indelible mark on you when you walk through those gates. You'll always remember it, and every Garda will remember the day they walk through those gates, yes.
1982,
yeah.
Ireland was a different place, and I suppose how society looked on members of an Garda Síochána Síochána was quite different as well, wasn't it?
Yes, it has changed, I suppose, from the 60s, 70s, right through the 80s. There has been probably a change, but I still think the guards have a huge part to play within the communities. They are relatively still well embedded through the GAA, through coaching, through a lot of other activities. So it has changed, and I suppose people's attitudes have changed. You know, some people would say maybe it's more violent now, but I would have been in the serious crime review team, and we would have reviewed crimes that were committed in the 70s, and unfortunately we were pretty violent to ourselves back in the 60s and 70s as well, but yeah, people don't have memories of it.
We'll get to that that review team that you were heading up, because there's a lot of talk at the moment, isn't there, about you know, staffing in an Garda Síochána, difficulty in recruiting new guards. Why do you think that is?
Well, there is huge commentary there in relation to the staffing and the retention of staff. And I would have seen that myself when I was serving. There's a number of, I suppose, points to be discussed. Number one, it's difficult for people to decide to go down to Templemore for €184 a week.
That's what they get, is it?
That's what they're getting. And that's very, very poor. So put yourself in the position of a young guard, or a young person who's making a decision they're going to join the guards, and maybe they have a mortgage, they have a family, or they have commitments or whatever. And then to go down to Templemore, it's intensive training.
And do you have to pay for accommodation out of that,
no,
Christy?
No, you don't. You don't have to pay for food or accommodation,
right.
But you still have to pay your mortgage or whatever bills you have,
yes,
or
yeah,
your loan for your car or whatever.
So that needs to be looked at.
It needs to be hugely looked at, yeah.
And the other thing that were mentioned was the retirement age. So you retired at 60.
Is that mandatory? That was compulsory,
right,
that I would retire. I literally retired on my 60th birthday. You close the door, you walk out, and it's as blunt and as blank as that.
And some people were saying they should stretch that age to maybe 62, because some people at that age have still a lot to offer, and they want to offer it.
Yes, and there are a considerable number of guards who would have a lot to offer. It just depends on what stage people are in their lives. But they have huge corporate knowledge, they have huge knowledge of the community, they have contacts within the community, they've built up a lot of relationships there. And to literally walk out, close the door, and you're not downloaded, nobody downloads you for all that information.
No.
Nobody gets a USB key and inserts it and says, listen, tell me what you know.
It seems like a big waste of corporate knowledge.
It's an enormous amount of corporate knowledge left behind, and that's right from the guard who's on the beat, the guard who's in the community policing section, detectives, right up to chief superintendent, all the ranks.
Okay.
It just goes with you.
Well, let's go back right to the start. Why did you join the Guards? Was there a history of it in the family?
No, absolutely no history in our family. My father had a garden nursery with my mum, mother, Claire and Oliver. They ran for a number of years. I would have worked in that. That was probably a big interest for me, was gardening and flowers and plants and so on and so forth. But I suppose an influence on me, one, a number of influences, I suppose. I did Dunshaughlin, if anybody knows it, the old Garda barracks was on the right hand side as you come in from Dublin. And handball was a big game there, so I would have went up there, and the Guards were always seemed to be pretty good at it, but it was the wall was at the back of it. Right. But I suppose the local sergeant, Seamus McGee, was an imposing figure, and I would have played a number of games against him, and he was a very, very powerful character, but a very good man. You listened to him when he spoke to you, and if he told people to go home, they went home. But you know, then there's a number of other things. I suppose I would have worked in an undertaker's in Dunshaughlin too. So look, that's it's a difficult profession. Well, I would have found it difficult. You know, you were making coffins and then digging graves, and you would have seen probably a different side to life with people, how they mourn and the tragedies maybe of, you know, traffic collisions, and look, people will die of old age. So there's, you know, you see all that. And then look at, I went to St. Pat's in Navan, you know, a very, very good school. It'll straighten you out for sure, St. Pat's. I enjoyed my time down there. But look at, I suppose, no more than a number of us at the time, we decided we'd take a day off or two. And Navan is known as the Bounce. Other places probably known as Mitchin, and so on and so forth. Probably I shouldn't have been Mitchin anyway. But anyway, myself and another colleague, as well as his friend at the time, we decided we'd go Mitchin, and this place called the Ramparts in Navan, and we were down there. We thought we were great. And having a cigarette and probably freezing cold as well. But anyway, we were walking along and he lost his footing and fell into the river. He was an excellent swimmer, very, very good swimmer. And we pulled him out eventually anyway, but sure, he was drowned wet. So struck on a great plan. I would go up to his house and get a set of clothes for him and bring them back, and things would be grand. But when I went up to Navan Town, up Trimgate Street, not a lot of traffic around the place. Got the set of clothes, I'm grand, no problem whatsoever. Coming back down, I could see a lot of very heavily armed men that had taken over Navan, and they were robbing the local bank. So I was looking on with great interest, and as I'm looking on with great interest, one of the raiders, Balaclava, military style, I suppose, clothing.
Yeah.
And he's staring at you and you're kind of wondering what's going on here, and, you know, what'll I do? And I was tall enough, young fella, I suppose, too. But he kept the gun trained at me, and you know.
Oh, he pointed a gun at you?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, sure. He was literally only maybe 6 or 8 feet away, very close. And
did he say anything to you?
Well, there was a load of shouting going on. It was absolute mayhem. Everybody was running everywhere, and look, I was just there on the footpath, you know, probably not I was taking it all in, and kind of was, look, I might have said later on, it was kind of like a movie, but it was a real life movie. But I spotted in the corner of my eye my sister across the road, and she was in her school uniform, but I didn't find out later, but she had been down there legitimately doing a message for the school teacher. So anyway, the raid took place and they took off, and to be fair, the guards took off after them, and there was a shootout, and the Sergeant Keyes, who's mentioned, was shots fired at him. So he was awarded a Scott Medal later on, but look at that. I was glad to get out of the place and got down and rescue me.
So you're impressed by the sergeant that you played handball with. You encountered death, I suppose, younger than most people would on a regular basis in the Undertakers.
Yeah.
And then you happened upon this scene. So those three things contributed to you making a decision to go into the Guards. Your first posting was in Sundrive, was it?
Sundrive Road, which when I heard it was going to Sundrive Road, somebody from Dublin told me that was on the border. And I was looking at maps, trying to figure out, obviously we had no Google and so on and so forth at the time, trying to figure out where this place was on the border. But somebody told me then eventually, that's in Crumlin.
Yeah.
So I would have had to live in Crumlin for a while because I had no car at the time and so on and so forth. So that was my first posting. And I would say an amazing posting because very busy area, very, very close to Dolphin's Barn, which was probably, you know, it's unfortunate, but it was a supermarket for any drug you wanted.
And there was a heroin epidemic, wasn't there, in the 80s?
Yeah, a terrible heroin epidemic swept across Dublin in particular.
So that was a tough introduction to the real world for you. I suppose you'd led a sort of a cosseted enough, had you?
Well, I'm from the country. I was from Dunshaughlin, a small village.
And there was no drugs in the 80s outside Dublin. They might probably in the other big cities, but in the main,
you wouldn't have seen drugs. You wouldn't have seen people injecting heroin. Yeah. You wouldn't have seen any of that. You certainly didn't see the violence that resulted from people. And it is a vicious circle because you have people taking drugs, then they need money so they go out and commit robberies. Mm. Then we would have been coming across them coming out of banks, building societies after committing robberies. And obviously their intent, hell-bent on getting away in their stolen car, and you have a basic 2-foot wooden batten. Which you wouldn't do a lot anyway, but you're trying to catch them. And I said, look, it's youth, youth and exuberance and so on and so forth, and you think there's no tomorrow.
Naivety, yeah. You think you're invincible, I suppose.
I'd say more you think you're invincible than naive, because you always realise that, a bullet could come and you're gone.
Was that something that you lived with every day?
Well, in the 80s in particular, when you were out with your partner in the patrol car or you were in the detective car, you were quite prepared for this is going to happen, because it was a very violent time and armed robberies were being committed on a daily basis. People would decide to rob a bank and they would get a large metal object, come in, smash down the glass and then rob the bank, jump over the counter, as jump overs they were called too, and out and into a stolen car and gone, and then the proceeds to head back to whatever.
And did you ever come upon one?
Oh, yes, many, many times. I suppose one of the first times I came across it was 1988. It was Christmas Eve, actually. No more than anybody else, I had to go into work. I was working 2 to 10. I was looking forward to the next day, Christmas
Day. There was a Christmas card you had to get for your wife.
Oh, that's right. I actually had my wife had said to me she likes cards, so for her, she said to me, make sure you get the Christmas card and so on and so forth. So I went up to the Crumlin Shopping Centre. To just see if I could get a Christmas card, but it was full, absolutely full. You couldn't get into it, so I said, right, there's a little shop up on Galtymore Road in Drimna, I'll nip up there and I'll get it. I was driving the patrol car, an automatic and so on and so forth. So on the way up, we were told by the Garda Control that an armed robbery had taken place in Drimna, in Walkinstown, and that they were gone across towards the Long Mile Road, which interlinks then with Drimna. So we were on our way up, we'll be up that way anyway and I'll still get the card as well. So they gave a very good description of the car, and there's three raiders in it and the two of them were armed and so on and so forth. So as we were pulling up towards the shop, Mick Minogue, a Clare man, was with me, a good Clare hurler. Mick was with me, and we saw the stolen car and the driver had his head down looking out through the steering wheel trying to conceal himself. So Mick got out of the passenger side. I jammed in the stolen car, put the patrol car in park so that he wouldn't be able to push, and he was spinning the wheels trying to push me out. A lot of smoke coming from the rear tyres of the stolen car. Mick went round the back of the car and then the driver reversed the car over him. I thought to myself, that's Mick dead. And then I'm with my baton, I'm trying to smash the window off the stolen car. Timber will not break. I needed metal, obviously. So as this is going on, the two raiders come out and they've guns, and they're screaming and roaring as not to move. Thankfully, Mick was struggling to get up off the ground, and I suppose it's what you do. Your natural reaction. He's screaming it and roaring at you not to move, and then you deal with him forcibly. You have to.
What did you do?
I had to hit him. That's it. He was going to kill me. He was shouting, get away, I'll shoot you. There was a lot of people around the place. And Mick and myself then disarmed him. And then the stolen car did a nice bit of damage to my patrol car, which I was kind of very concerned about because I was only driving the car a week. And you get in trouble for
damage, do you?
Oh, you would. You get in a lot of trouble for...
There's a sort of dark sense of humour in the Gardaí as well, obviously.
There is. But it worked out. The guy, we arrested him, he was charged. He actually was people mightn't think this, but he actually was a nice guy.
Oh, here's the thing. Yeah. Right, this is what I want to talk to you about, Christy, because how many murder cases have you covered in your career?
It is in excess of 100.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
I've been around a long time.
Yeah. So you've spoken to an awful lot of murderers in your time.
I have.
Like most people wouldn't encounter a murderer in a lifetime.
No, and they're lucky. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's a humanity about your approach.
Yeah, I think you have to have a humanity with people when you're dealing with so many people, because people find themselves in difficult circumstances. And I always try and explain to guards in particular, because look, for the 40 years, last 40 years, I've been dealing with a lot of guards. But you have to understand that if a serious crime takes place, and look, murder is the most serious of all crimes, and the family of the victim suffer badly. They really, really do. A terrible tragedy has taken place, and forevermore, they're never going to be in the happy place they were in prior to this. But the suspect's family, the offender's family, or whatever we would call them, and eventually they're convicted, that family also suffers a sentence, because the mum and dad are invariably very, very decent people. This, they never expected it would happen. And then they have to live their lives. And I would have got a huge understanding from speaking to suspects' families in particular, because you need to get an understanding of where the murderer came from, who they were, why did they end up like this, how did it happen. Now, look, some of them are just plain bad. They're bad people.
Would you say that's the minority of murders? Like, because I'm intrigued about evil. You know,
yeah.
Are some people that you encounter just evil?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, so some people are, and a number of them, and thankfully I couldn't say it was a huge amount, but certainly you would say there's certain people when you catch them in the eye, you'd say, right, well, I know that you will try and kill me. I know that you're going to try and kill me, so I will deal with you appropriately. Now, you'll always be on your guard when you're dealing with somebody, particularly violent people and so on and so forth. But there are certain people you'd say, right, you're to the bone evil.
Okay. So the other group of people, have they got anything in common? You say in the book, which I'm fascinated by as well, that we're all capable of committing murder. Now, I don't know if I agree with you.
I think I said most.
Oh, you said most of us, right. Most of us.
Well, I do think most of us, and actually somebody said it to me yesterday. They were with a very small child, a two-year-old child. And somebody said to me, I don't think you're right there, Christy. And I said, well, okay. I put the scenario to you. That beautiful two-year-old is there with you, and that person is coming through a door and they have a knife or a gun. What would you do to protect that child? You would do your utmost to protect the child. Well, I certainly would. And, you know, if somebody has been tackled in a given set of circumstances, I think, look, it's just a fight or flight.
Okay.
And I invariably would have been involved in the fight. But, you know, most people, I think...
So self-defence.
Yeah.
When you put that caveat I agree with you. Yes. To protect our loved ones.
Protect your loved ones, maybe to protect your house.
Yes.
Maybe to protect whatever else. So, you know...
Now I was saying at the outset that you've been across some of the most famous murder cases in the history of the state. Farah Swala Noor.
Yes.
And his remains were found in the canal. He had been sawn up, cut up, and put in a carrier bag or a suitcase and placed in the canal. And the crime was committed in flat 170 in Richmond Cottages, Ballybock. Where were you when you got the call about that find, the find in the canal?
That find, I was getting ready to go out. There's a small place called Batterstown, it's in County Mead. Anybody who knows it's on the way to Trim, beautiful place. And I was coaching a Camogie team, Black Isle Gael's Camogie team. Fantastic set of girls that are involved down there. So I was getting ready to go out and train the team because we had a championship match coming up. I literally had put on tracksuit, the usual what all coaches wear. So I go out onto the pitch and getting the drills ready and so on and so forth. So I obviously have my phone with me because you're on call all the time. I was the detective inspector in Fitzgibbon Street at the time. So I'm getting a phone call from Colin Fox. Colin, unfortunately, is deceased recently. So Colin is ringing me and Colin is saying, that there's body parts in the canal. And look at Ibis, saying, look, we've often seen it before where, people would dress up dummies and throw them in and so on and so forth. And it's happened on a number of occasions. So I kind of said to Colin, look, sure, you know, do you need me to go in and what, you know, what do you want? And look, I was the senior investigating officer if it was a murder case. So I said, right, would you mind asking one of the fire crew that were there, will they just jump into the canal and see what they find? So Colm is on the phone, he has it open and I'm listening and he's talking to the fire crew, who were brilliant actually, and they used a fire drag rake, and next thing Colm says, yeah, this is a body part, Christy, you better come in. Or he would have called me Kig at the time, that's what we were called.
Kigra.
Kigra, yeah.
Kigra.
Yeah,
it's, so that was the beginning of that case for you.
And we're, yeah.
Hold that thought. I'm going to take a commercial break and we'll talk more to Christy Mangan about his new book, Cracking the Case, Inside the Mind of a Top Garda, after this.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Tweet at Radio Ray RTE. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now we're speaking to Christy Mangan. His new book is called Cracking the Case, Inside the Mind of a Top Garda. So we're going to continue talking about the case of the murder of Farah Swala Noor after Nocht. We'll have a minute to go. So writing this book, Christy, because I did mention that you're the first retired senior Garda to do such a thing. Did you have to think about it a lot? Did you have to seek counsel, advice?
I had a lot of soul searching myself, yeah. Because look at the, you know, there's a lot of, I suppose, confidences that you didn't want to, you don't want to breach. And then yes, I did seek advice from people that I would have highly respected. I would have spoken to Barry Cummins. You know, Barry, yeah, has written a number of books, and other journalists and authors. And I suppose their message to me, well, you have a story to tell, and you know, and it has a lot of facts. It's a very factual based story. You've been involved in a lot of serious criminal investigations, and what they were telling me was that the public may be interested in knowing what goes on in an investigation team.
Yeah. And your relationship, and we're going to talk more about this, but your relationship, the relationship you struck up with Linda Mulhall, for example, who was one of the people who murdered Farah Swala Noor, or was it manslaughter on her?
Manslaughter, yeah.
Yes. It was her sister who
her
was
sister,
the,
Charlotte,
murder,
yeah.
And that's important to get that.
It is very important,
right.
Yeah.
Okay,
yes.
So we're going to talk to Christy Moore, but Anish Toshin and the Priestgelton and Nogtala, Kieran Afarda. Gramaga, Kieran, Christy Mangan is with us, retired Chief Superintendent. Cracking the Case is his new book. So you were the senior investigating officer.
Yes, I was in charge of the...
On the murder of Farah Swala Noor.
Yes.
So you got the call. It was found in the canal. The body was found in the canal. It wasn't all the body.
No, it wasn't all the body. There was a number of body parts missing. Mainly the head was missing, which obviously was very important for identification purposes. So we set up our murder investigation team. Next day, very, very busy day, because it's right in Ballybock Bridge. We had, you know, the night before, we had young people throwing coins in, trying to spit on the remains. And then we had to close down the bridge, which wasn't a very popular decision because it's a main artery into Dublin. And then set about your technical examination, trying to establish who the deceased was, which, yeah, proved very, very problematic because we couldn't find any record of him.
This is fascinating. People would be fascinated by the science behind this,
yeah,
because it's isotope research.
Isotope research, yeah.
So there's a guy in Belfast, he, yeah, said to you, I want samples of water from all the various Garda stations.
Garda stations in Dublin.
And by getting those samples, yeah, he could tell you where that man had lived.
Yeah, he could tell us. He was able to give us a broad range of, I think it was up to 6 months, that he would have lived in the Ballybock area, which was significant when we had nothing as regards identifying this person. So we knew then that they had frequented the Ballybock area at least for that period of time. And then it obviously, we were able to concentrate a lot of our efforts in the Ballybock area, doing our media appeals, and the media, obviously, in this case, was hugely, hugely important.
Because the goriness of it, but there was a nearly a perverse interest in it, wasn't there?
Initially there was a difficulty in that, you know, the story that would have been in the media, that it was a voodoo killing, and I would have carried out a lot of research in relation to voodoo killings, and including the Boy Adam case in London, tragic case, and we would have contacted the ritual killings unit in South Africa, I would have spoken with a priest who had a huge amount of experience in dealing with. He worked in
the
in
missions.
Africa.
Yeah.
Yeah, he worked over there. He was a brilliant guy, and I would have sat down with him and obviously with the ritual killing unit and explained to him what we had. And unfortunately, they were leaning towards that we had a ritual killing, which wasn't something I wanted to hear because it was going to be very difficult. Maybe the people who were involved had gone and they had taken the body parts that they needed. And, you know, how do you follow the evidence there? But we did a number of appeals, and eventually then we got the Ireland away white jersey was very, very important. And we got a big response when we went out with the jersey, and we got a number of people came and said, listen, I think I know who that person is. And then one person in particular told us that they had seen Farah on down in O'Connell Street, and he had been with Kathleen and the two girls.
So Kathleen Mulhall and yeah. Linda and Charlotte.
Linda and Charlotte, yeah. So that set us off on that trail.
Now, we're not going to go into details, but there are details in the book.
Yes.
The sisters were found guilty of manslaughter and murder, and the mother was found guilty of interfering with the course of justice, whatever the technical term for that is. But you, I suppose, got a confession from Linda.
Yes. Yeah.
And one of the things she said to you, you asked her, why did she confess? And she said, because you were nice to me.
Yeah. Throughout the time we were I think sometimes people think a murder investigation takes place and is over within a couple of weeks. It's not. I think this murder investigation took over 4 years to complete from the day the call came in to the final court case. So a murder investigation takes an enormous amount of time to get to completion
and work
and at some stages in this investigation we had in excess of 100 officers, 100 detectives working on this case.
Is that house to house?
House to house. CCTV in this case in particular.
Is that a huge part of it?
Oh, huge, huge. We had to take, this was committed close to Croke Park, so we had to take the Croke Park CCTV system. A lot of other TV systems, but businesses in around the city centre. But to be fair, that was of benefit because when we took it, we didn't know what we were actually going to find, what we were looking for. But when we discovered who the people were involved, we were able to then track those people on the video, yeah. on the CCTV. So it takes an enormous amount of stamina and energy and resources to run a murder investigation. And you're not only doing that murder investigation. In April 2005, I was investigating four murders in total that had happened in that month. So and I'm not unique to that. It happens with other senior investigators.
What you're saying is you're stretched. You were stretched.
You were very stretched. Okay. You're very stretched. And you're dealing with all the other terrible crimes that take place, including assaults and armed robberies and very, very serious cases.
Is a confession the perfect case for you?
I would say a confession certainly is hugely beneficial, but obviously science is very important. Mm.
Did you present the science in order to get the confession? Did you go, we know that there's, for example, blood stains there, we know that this happened?
Well, we arrested Charlotte, Linda, and
Kathleen,
and the father, John. They were detained for 12 hours, and we got no evidence.
Right,
and in fact, we got no charge. It was probably a very, very deflating time for me personally, but certainly for the investigation team, because we'd put months and months of work into this and thought we had a particularly good case. But then our legal advice told us, no, you're not getting a charge of murder. And then you have to release these people. They all have to go about their own ways. And then at that time, I had been requested by my chief superintendent to move to Store Street to deal with, a number of matters there. I actually loved Fitzgibbon Street because it had the added bonus on a Sunday. I had to attend Croke Park to work.
You had to attend Croke Park. Mm.
So it was sort of a personal thing there.
Yeah.
But anyway, I then had to prepare the case for literally that was it. It had gone as far as maybe.
And that was it. Could. And you were told at that time to forget, move on.
Well, to be fair, you have to move on. You do with the cases that you have. You just can't remain with one case all the time.
So what happened after?
Well, what happened then was I was working with Sergeant Liam Hickey and myself, and we had spoken to John, and John had told
us. The dad.
The dad, yeah. He was a tough man, but he was very respectful with us. He was a strong Dublin character, very respectful to us. He had a respect for us because when he was being arrested, he was allowed to have a cigarette before he got into the patrol car.
And again, that's the humanity of it.
That struck a chord with him. So, look, obviously, he told us at a later stage that Linda knew where the head was and so on and so forth. So he told us, listen, you should go back up and have a talk with her. And we said, OK, we'll have to prepare for that. So we went up on a Friday and knocked at the door and spoke with Linda, and she would have been probably quite hostile to us. Hostile in sort of a polite way. Listen, get out, go away. I'm going to sue you. You falsely arrested me, and so on and so forth. Mm. But when she calmed down, listen, okay, have a cup of tea. And she made the tea, and look at, you could see that she was under pressure, and she did nothing wrong. And I, spoke at length with her, and then left the house in Kilclare and Talla, and then you're driving back towards Fitzgibbon Street with another matter to deal with over on the north side. And she rings me, and she's very emotional. She says, come back. And I said, okay, but I still was conscious of the fact that whatever I was going to do had to be done legally, because there's no point in going back up and taking a full step and then ending up in the courts and the case would be thrown out. So I needed to get that right. So I had to calm, just don't rush back up, take your time, discuss it with other people, what you need to do. So I went back up, I think it was 5:15 or whatever, and went into her bedroom and took a very, very lengthy, that could have been a 20-page statement, a very lengthy detailed statement.
Do you record that or write it down?
You can't record it in the house because I didn't have the facility, but it's written down. So she's very emotional.
And that's transcribed in the book.
Yeah, she's very emotional. But you could see the relief in her. She was relieved to have told us what had happened, because she said that it had deeply affected her. She had a tough life, and she said it had very this act had deeply affected her, and she was basically glad to have told us. So in order to make sure that I had the case legally sound, I brought her up to Tallaght station and I put her on audio visual. So
and got her to do the statement again.
She recanted, or she recanted, and went through the statement again.
And that's the basis of the conviction in the end.
That's the basis of the conviction. It ended up in the courts, and Linda was convicted of manslaughter.
What about we're running out of time. I could talk to you forever, Christy, because you were. The first man to do the cold cases in Ireland. So there's like the Father Malloy cases in the book as well. And then you moved up to Drogheda at a time when Drogheda was in rag order with drug violence, and you had to oversee that. And in the middle of that, then that poor Keen Mulready Woods, 17, was murdered. But the reporting of that particular, and the fact that those two sisters were called what they were called, and all of that, it does take the humanity out of it, doesn't it? Like it portrays these people as animals, and you didn't find them as animals, did you?
No, they weren't. No. Well, particularly with the Mulhall case, but the Keane Mulready Woods case was different, because initially, when we were discovering that Keane had been murdered.
I'm going to stop you there because the details are in the book, and I'm aware that we're an afternoon audience. But it a fascinating insight into the job that you did over 40 years, and I think people will be fascinated by it. And as I said, some of the most high profile murder cases that the state has witnessed in its history. Christy, enjoy your sort of half retirement.
Thank you.
And I'm sure we'll talk again.
No doubt.
I'd like to talk to you more, but we've run out of time. So cracking the case inside the mind of a top Garda, Chief Superintendent Christy Mangan. Thanks, Christy.
Thanks. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.